Good afternoon. Welcome to Division 1 of the Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our afternoon docket. And the first one is People versus Gross. Our counsel here and ready for argument? Thank you. The second one that we have on our document is Schmidt Construction versus Lennar with Colorado Asphalt Pavement Association as amicus. Counsel here on that case. Okay, thank you. On the first case of People versus Gross, have counsel had the opportunity to read our handout concerning our policies and procedures in oral argument? And do you have any questions about any of those? You know that you have a lighting system where you can monitor the time yourself now, and appellant, you can reserve the amount of time that you want to reserve for rebuttal. And if you want me to try to help you with that, let me know what you might want to reserve, and I'll try to do my best to give you some notice about that. As for everyone else in the audience, please make sure that if you have a cell phone or a pager or anything like that that might go off during oral arguments, that you turn it off so the counsel and the court are not disturbed during oral arguments. With that, we are ready to proceed. So, counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Mark Walter, registration number 30990. I'm appearing on behalf of Charles Gross, the defendant appellant in this matter. I just quickly bring to the court's attention that the state's petition for certiorari was denied on February 8th in People versus Lara, which has been a case off-cited here. I'd also ask at the outset to reserve 2 minutes if the court could give me a heads up. That would be great. Yes, thank you. I think it probably behooves me to start with the discussion of invited error, which is really a threshold issue in this case. The doctrine's been squarely invoked with respect to the initial aggressor instruction, as well as the court's response to the jury question. The state appears to concede that the incomplete self-defense instruction and the related misstatements of law by the prosecution are both subject to plain error review. The strict or wooden application of invited error endorsed by the majority in Zapata and urged by the state in this case, I would submit, has been abandoned in favor of Chief Justice's Quinn's more flexible approach that he formulated in his special concurrence in Zapata. The Supreme Court's more recent decision in Stewart essentially adopts that special concurrence and the reasoning underlying it. The state of the law in Colorado post-Stewart is that errors resulting from inadvertence or attorney incompetence, and it might be added negligence, are reviewable under plain error. Wittrein, which is the case cited by the state in its recent supplemental submission, is not to the contrary. In that case, if the court will notice, the Supreme Court, despite finding invited error, then proceeded to engage in the plain error analysis. And this is precisely the sort of, quote, salutary course that Chief Justice Quinn endorsed in his special concurrence. So even if the court were to conclude that the errors in question here were invited, and we certainly don't agree with that, it should nevertheless follow the salutary course of reviewing for plain error in this case. I'll now turn to the collection of errors that we assert resulted in deprivation of Mr. Gross's right to present a defense. The errors arising from both the faulty self-defense instructions, the prosecution's related misstatements of law, and the court's erroneous response to the jury's question all rise to the level of plain error. Mr. Gross was plainly entitled to a self-defense law instruction with regards to extreme indifference murder at the time of trial. And the trial court was, in fact, statutorily obligated give one under the plain terms of 18.1 704 sub 4. And I would add, whether requested or not, and our position is that the language of the statute, once evidence of self-defense is introduced at trial, mandates the court to give the sort of self-defense law instruction provided for under that subsection.
Mr. Walter, let me ask you a question, if I may. What is the practical difference between the self-defense instruction that you're saying should have been given here for the extreme indifference murder charge and the self-defense instruction that was given on the second-degree murder and second-degree assault charges?
Well, the practical difference is that that instruction by its plain terms didn't apply to extreme indifference murder, and the prosecution, in fact, argued to the jury that self-defense was not applicable to extreme indifference murder.
Well, I appreciate that, but what I'm trying to focus on is whether in terms of the specific argument that would have been made by Mr. Gross as to the facts that related to self-defense, would they have been any different for extreme indifference murder? And I recognize, of course, that one is legal self-defense, defense, and the other is an affirmative defense.
Right, and that's the reason that I think Lara is particularly illuminating in terms of distinguishing between the two defenses as they relate to those respective offenses.
So what I'm asking, though, and I may not have asked it clearly, so let me try one more time.
Sure.
From a factual standpoint, isn't it the case that for both extreme indifference murder and for second-degree murder and second-degree assault, the facts that Mr. Gross would have been relying on would have been the same things that the victim made a movement to that made Mr. Gross think that he was pulling a weapon out?
Pardon me, Your Honor.
And also that the victim was driving his pickup towards Mr. Gross?
I think that's largely true. I think it would have been based on the same constellation of facts. And if Your Honor's concern is, well, okay, so why then didn't the jury acquit him of second-degree murder and second-degree assault, the offenses to which self-defense expressly applied? My response to that would be, well, the problem is that there were other errors in the self-defense instructions that I think fatally undermined the defense. More specifically, the initial aggressor exception, which I think absolutely vitiated the defense. As the court is well aware, initial aggressor acts as an exception to self-defense. One who is an initial aggressor may still assert the right to self-defense, provided that he or she is able to overcome the statutory obstacles that are erected, namely that they withdraw from the affray. Second, that they communicate the intent to withdraw from the affray. And thirdly, that the other person then persists or in their unlawful physical act or initiate against the defendant. And of course, the problem in this case is that while there was certainly evidence from Mr. Gross's side that he had walked away from the pickup truck at some point, I don't think there was any evidence that he had ever effectively communicated that to the Madrids. And therein lies the problem. And therein, I think, and quite apart from that, as the prosecution itself recognized below, Mr. Gross's verbal confrontation with the Madrids, as a matter of both fact and law, probably did not render him the initial aggressor in the first place. So what you have here is, and I think we've been very forthright about this, the defense tenders an instruction that takes Mr. Gross, or has the effect of taking him out of self-defense. if you look...
Sorry to interrupt. As you've thought about this case, can you envision a reason trial counsel would have requested this instruction?
Well, I've certainly thought a lot about that, Your Honor. You know, in part, I can only go based on what defense counsel said below. And it appears to me, and I want to be fair about this, that the position taken was that because Mr. Gross turned and walked away, well, first of all, because the jury might view him as the initial aggressor as a result of the verbal confrontation, he wanted to make sure that there was a way to get Mr. Gross back into the realm of self-defense. Of course, the fundamental problem with that is, as a matter of law, Mr. Gross was not an initial aggressor under those circumstances, as I think the prosecution rightly recognized.
The prosecutor didn't object to self-defense as an instruction.
No, absolutely not. You know, so as far as I can tell, defense counsel's rationale for seeking the initial aggressor instruction proceeded from the faulty premise that he was, in fact, the initial aggressor under the law. But beyond that, the problem with the defense's position was that while they may have been able to establish withdrawal from the affray, what they could not have established, and I don't think there was any evidence to this extent, that he had ever in any manner effectively communicated that withdrawal to the Madrids. So here you have a situation where the defense has erected rather significant obstacles, probably obstacles that they couldn't overcome in terms of assertion of the defense of self-defense, you know, which is why I would urge the court not to buy into the view that, well, the jury had the opportunity to consider this defense with respect to two of the offenses charged, and nevertheless elected to find him guilty.
So is it your position that this case needs to be remanded for a 35C hearing?
No. I think the appropriate course, and the one that I think Justice Quinn adopted, and I think is the state of the law in Colorado right now, is there's no sense in kicking the can down the road on a 35C. If the court perceives plain error on appeal, call it plain error and reverse. But requiring defendants to take the additional step of pursuing post-conviction remedies.
Well, how would you establish attorney incompetence otherwise?
I don't think that there's a requirement that you go through the Strickland steps on appeal. The question simply is, here we have an error that appears to be plain in character. And if we find it to be both plain and to meet the standard of reversal for plain error, then we reverse. You know, the invited error doctrine and Zapata's formulation of it is problematic on a number of levels, and it's not something that we necessarily need to litigate or resolve here. But I think that there needs to be a recognition, at least in this context, in the instructional context, where you have an erroneous instruction submitted to the court. The court bears some responsibility for the erroneous instruction. I understand that Zapata says that defendants should abide by the consequences. But the reality is the trial court always has a duty and obligation to correctly instruct. And I think it's fair under those circumstances, and remember, invited error is an equitable doctrine. And I think in most circumstances, given the weighty rights that criminal defendants have, and given the societal interests in fair criminal proceedings, that equity in most instances should tilt in the defendant's favor.
Mr. Walter, suppose that there were a 35C proceeding here to determine whether the defendant's trial counsel did have a strategic reason for asking for the initial aggressor instruction? And you told us a few minutes ago you weren't aware of what the trial counsel's motivation was in asking for such an instruction. Might not that make a difference?
In terms of elucidating the defense counsel's rationale?
Right.
I'm sure that a proceeding such as that would certainly shed light on it.
It seems to me there's a tension on the one hand between saying, well, this is not only error, but it was plain error, and therefore we should reverse on the one hand, and on the other hand, the Supreme Court's admonition that if something was a strategic error, it's not invited error, and if it's a strategic error, then that would seem to have a bearing on the analysis.
Yeah, and my personal position is that the strategic versus non-strategic is probably not the most enlightening approach to this. I understand that's what the case is saying, and the court is bound by that. But at the same time, I think what you have seen from the court is that there's a rough judgment made as to whether the error was strategic or not, and they proceed to engage in plain error. In Wittrain, they actually proceeded to the plain error analysis irrespective of the finding that was invited error.
You have about 30 seconds left, Mr. Walden.
I think I'm going to retain the rest of my time and hand it over to the Attorney General.
Thank okay. You.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here on behalf of the state of Colorado. I'd like to talk first about the second issue, the self-defense jury instruction issue. I think the best way to start is to say we're not going to contest that an instruction probably should have been given. However, the trial court's failure to give that instruction didn't amount to plain error and didn't prejudice the defendant, such that it substantially affected the verdict, and here's why. In the first place, the case law at the time explicitly stated that self-defense just wasn't a defense to extreme indifference murder. In the second place,
let me interrupt you right there,
sure.
Mr. Michaels. Regardless of the fact that the Lara case hadn't yet been decided, the statute, I don't remember the number of it, but I'm sure you know it,
sure.
Had already been in effect for several years. So wouldn't that make a difference?
Your Honor is correct. It had been in effect for a few years, 704, for this court hadn't had a chance to interpret it, and obviously the People versus Lara decision hadn't been rendered. The statute itself, it says if the defendant puts on enough evidence for a self-defense instruction, shall be instructed with respect to extreme indifference murder, and then says that it's also not entitled as an affirmative defense. And there's a little tension there, as you pointed out, I believe yourself pointed out, on with Mr. Walta. And secondly, it's confusingly worded. It hadn't been described here necessarily. And the case law explicitly says that a finding of self-defense, or to find a defendant guilty of extreme indifference murder, means implicitly a rejection of self-defense because it rejects the action of self-defense as a reasonable action. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. The statute, as you pointed out, was new and it hadn't been discussed. And the finding of self-defense, or in order to find self-defense, in order to find extreme indifference murder, you have to reject self-defense. Furthermore, here, as the trial counsel was discussing jury instructions, the defense counsel explicitly agreed that in this case, and I realize this is contrary to the statute, but the defense counsel stated, we don't believe that an instruction is warranted or necessary with respect to extreme indifference murder. Now, People versus Lara clarified the requirements of the statute and, as not relevant here, ruled part of it unconstitutional. Here, the trial court didn't issue any affirmative misinstruction to the jury. It didn't change the burden that the defense counsel would have to the prosecution would have to prove. It didn't lower that burden. It simply said self-defense as considered, as you said, second-degree murder and second-degree assault. So the jury had that information in front of them. They knew they had to consider self-defense. Secondly, self-defense here, although the defendant was able to raise that scintilla of evidence necessary for the instruction, the evidence just wasn't enough to raise the point where it was a viable defense. And here's why. In the first place, we have no weapon found whatsoever from the Madrid's vehicle. Both Mr. Madrid and his son testified that the defendant approached them threateningly, erratically, and within seconds drew his firearm and shot at them four times at very close range. We have an expert witness testifying that, contrary to defendant's statements on the witness stand, the car never accelerated towards them, in fact, accelerated at a high rate of speed away from the shooting as the Madrids tried to escape from the shooting.
Counsel, sorry to interrupt, I just have a question. Did the DA below object to self-defense?
In terms of having an instruction issued?
Yes.
No, he did not.
So this is your argument, not his or her?
Hers, I believe. And it's my argument that self-defense should have been given. Or
no, why? I mean, if the prosecutor didn't argue that below, I mean,
in terms of whether there was enough evidence for a self-defense instruction,
correct.
I'm not arguing that there wasn't enough for the instruction. I'm arguing that the weight of the evidence was contrary to a finding that would allow self-defense to be a viable defense. If that distinction makes sense for Your Honor. And lastly, we have two statements from the defendant himself, one of which is that the car never accelerated towards him, and the other one of which is that he was motivated in the shooting by rage, pure rage. And I think that bears a quick moment of discussion before we talk about invited error again. And some of the briefs don't address in great detail is that Mr. Gross was Miranda'd immediately upon his arrest. He was told every one of his Miranda rights. He stated that he acknowledged it and he understood it. He stated that explicitly to the officer, and that was largely uncontested at the time of the trial. So the only question there is whether handing him the newspaper was coercion such that his will was overborne. And in this case, you can look at the context of that particular statement, of that action, and you see that Gross was doing all the talking. He was telling the arresting officer about things that he observed in the wilderness, how he had thought about hopping a train to run, how he had thought about turning himself in because he knew he had shot at and killed Mrs. Madrid, and how he wasn't a cop killer, and how he offered them his gun. These are all elements indicating his knowledge of what was going on, and that he was talking about having already been advised of his Miranda rights, aware of his Miranda rights, and there's nothing that says a Miranda waiver must be explicit. So I think the only question there is, again, was his will overborne in being handed a newspaper? As for the invited error that Mr. Walter spent a good deal of time with his argument on, it's the people's position that this is just textbook invited error with respect to the initial ingressor instruction. The defendant asked for it. The prosecution objected to it. The defense counsel then proceeded to continue to argue for it and ultimately got it from the trial court. The case People versus Gregor, which I believe was authored by Judge Taubman, specifically stated that a defendant can't complain on appeal of a jury instruction that he himself put forth. And that's the case that we have here. People versus Stewart is another illuminative case here. And that specific case says that there's a difference between strategic omission and just mere oversight. And here we have a case of a strategically submitted jury instruction.
What makes it strategic?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. And we talked about this a little bit with the opposing counsel, and we don't know. That's the problem. The whole, anything that we would come up with would be speculative at best, which, as you yourself pointed out, pretty much means this is the wrong forum for any kind of discussion about trial court strategic.
Well, let's assume for the sake of argument that it's incompetence, that it should not have been requested or put before the jury.
Okay.
Would it still be then invited error, or would it fall under a plain error analysis?
For the sake of argument, if it was attorney incompetence, at best,
I understand there's no record for that. I'm just saying for the sake of argument.
For the sake of argument, it would probably go under a plain error. But even so, at best, it would be cumulative. And People versus, I'm going to butcher this name, Manzarnas, says as much. If the language, if the charge is given with all the elements to the jury for the jury to be able to consider what the defendant has been charged with. So even if you do decide to do it, it's nothing more than cumulative. Are there any other questions? The only other extension that I would talk about this is with the no duty to retreat instruction. It's the people's position that, again, it's a continuation of the invited error, because once the initial aggressor instruction was tendered, the duty to retreat became something of an issue. And even if so, again, it's not just not plain error. There was no substantially affecting the verdict with the lack of this instruction. The weight was overwhelming in terms of defendant's guilt and the fact that he just didn't have a self-defense defense.
Well, would you agree with Mr. Walta that there was no evidence the defendant communicated an intent to withdraw?
For the sake of argument, he didn't explicitly say, I have been an aggressor and now I'm going to back off. He did.
He just said any evidence.
He approached the car threateningly, which again isn't enough to merit an instruction, but the trial court might have thought it was. And he then turned his back, despite saying that he was in fear of his life, turned his back on them and walked away before wheeling around and firing at them. And he said explicitly that he wasn't driven by fear, he was driven by rage. And
so
I think
you would agree then with Mr. Walta that there is no evidence?
There's no specific direct evidence saying I have withdrawn. Okay. If there are no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm his convictions in all respects. And I thank this court for his time. Thank you.
I know my time is short, Your Honors. Just to address your point, Judge Kalman, the statute had been in effect for 4 years at the time of trial in this case. It's clear as day. And moreover, it incorporated the language from this court's Roberts decision, which had been around for 10 years. With that, we respectfully ask that the court reverse the judgment and remand this case for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Both counsel, for your arguments today. This matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.